MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
Good afternoon, Dr. Ross Walker. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Brent. I'm sorry about that mix-up.
That's all right, mate. No problems. I hope you've had a lovely break and you're all raring and ready to go.
Absolutely. We had a wonderful time. Went up to the Whitsunday Passage and had a wonderful few days up there. It was magnificent.
Beautiful. Okay. Let's go straight to some of the topics that we're going to talk about today. And the first thing we're going to talk about is Parkinson's. And interestingly, yesterday, April 11, what's today, April 12, yesterday was World Parkinson's Day. It was, and it's part of World Parkinson's Awareness Month when the world comes together to shine a light on Parkinson's, which, as we know, is a progressive and degenerative condition of the central nervous system. But you've got some news that's interesting in reference to an ultrasound that can improve Parkinson's symptoms for up to 1 year.
Yeah, this is really interesting. And it was a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is, of course, the premier medical journal in the world. So when a study has reached the New England Journal, you know it's got to be pretty good stuff and done well. So they took a group of people with significant Parkinson's disease and gave them this treatment called focused ultrasound. But the interesting thing about this this study is they also had a sham group, which means they took a group of people who thought they were getting the treatment. So there could be no placebo effect with this at all. So neither group knew what they were getting. And they found that the people who had the focused ultrasound, so this is ultrasound that's done from outside the skull, so there's no cutting, there's no electrodes inserted, and they focus on a particular part of the brain called the globus pallidus, which is involved in mediating a lot of the problems that happen with Parkinson's disease. And they found that after 3 months, there was twice the improvement in all the movement problems that people get with Parkinson's, which for someone who suffers it at a significant level, it's a hideous condition. And they also found that in the people who were responders to the initial treatment, after 12 months, 77% of people still had significant improvements. So what we're talking about here is that rather than having to be on the Parkinsonian drugs, which are highly effective, but also have a lot of side effects, we're talking about a potential simple ultrasound technique where you go home that day that can be effective even 12 months later. It's really quite exciting. There's other treatments that do work as well, like the deep brain stimulation, but that is neurosurgery. It's minimal neurosurgery, so we're not talking about a huge scar in the skull, but they still have to have electrodes implanted into the brain. It's much more finicky to do it. So I think this is a big deal. It's quite exciting for people with Parkinson's. And also, interestingly, I've shown that focused ultrasound helps with a thing called benign essential tremor, which is almost like the Clayton's form of Parkinson's disease, but still very disabling for people when they have an essential tremor, even without Parkinson's disease, because they still can't hold a teacup properly. A lot of people are musicians. They can't play the piano or whatever properly because they're handshaking too much. So there's a lot of benefits to this focused ultrasound. It's quite exciting therapy.
With the study that they did, Ross, were they using people that were suffering from Parkinson's disease? I mean, were they looking at how far down the track people were suffering? I mean, some obviously would suffer Parkinson's a lot worse than others because they've had it longer.
Yeah. It wasn't just for people with minor early disease. The people had established disease. Interestingly, with the studies done on the deep brain stimulation, they get the best results if they do the procedure 4 years before at the start of the diagnosis. So if you've had the diagnosis for less than 4 years, you get the best response with deep brain stimulation. I'm not sure what the situation is with the focused ultrasound because I don't think it's been done for long enough in that many people.
But it sounds exciting news.
Yeah, very exciting news.
Researchers find a source of depression linked to a single enzyme. Researchers at Wuhan University in China have found a previously unknown mechanism linking gut bacteria and depression in women.
Yeah, and can I ask you, mate, for the years that you and I have been doing this segment together, how much have we spoken about the importance of gut bacteria? And this is yet another example. Now, this is interesting. We're talking about premenopausal women who suffer depression. There's a few levels to this study. Firstly, and this is a really elegant study because it has so many aspects to it. So they took a bunch of premenopausal women, compared to premenopausal women who didn't have depression, so ones who did and ones who didn't, and they measured what's called the estradiol levels, which is the primary female hormone of premenopausal women. They found that the premenopausal women with depression had a 43% reduction in their estradiol levels. So then, and also the estradiol is metabolized through the gut and then into the liver. And so then what they did was they looked at the gut microbiota in the premenopausal women with depression as opposed to those without depression. And they found that that the bad bacteria that the premenopausal women had really markedly broke down the estradiol. So then they took the gut bacteria of these premenopausal women, put it into mice, and found that the mice exhibited symptoms and signs of mice depression, whatever that might be, so cowering in a corner and not moving and not doing stuff that they normally do. Then they found the bug called Klebsiella aurigines, and they found that there was a markedly increased in premenopausal women, certainly in the mice with the depression. And then they treated the mice with an antibiotic that killed this Klebsiella, and their depressive symptoms improved. So they found a much higher level of estradiol in the mice treated with the antibiotics to get rid of this, or the mice who didn't have this particular Klebsiella bug. So what we're talking about now is rather than putting people on long-term antidepressants or all the rather intensive therapies for depression, if premenopausal women are getting depressed, we could go searching for this particular bug in their stool and kill the bug and possibly treat their depression, which I think is quite exciting stuff.
Can I ask you, is there a test that you can have to show the condition of the bacteria in your gut? Is it a good level or a bad level? Is there a test you can have?
It's a great question. And the answer to that is yes, but there's really only one lab in Australia that does the test. Now, I'm not really allowed on air to give the name of that lab because, they'll be flooded with requests, and it's got to be something that a doctor does. But again, I somebody could send me an email and at my office, and I could give out the name. But you see, there's the gut microbiome and the gut microbiota. Now, I know this is getting a bit confusing, but the microbiome is basically just sending your stool off to any local pathology place, and they just do really DNA mapping. They do DNA mapping of all the stuff to see exactly what's going on. All right, but that really doesn't tell you the concentration of different colonies of bacteria. What this particular lab does, which is down in Melbourne, is look at how much bacteria have, what type of bacteria they are, and how they're affecting the gut. What sort of chemicals are being released by these bugs? So it's a much more detailed look at your gut microbiota, which is really the function of these bacteria within your gut.
What are the signs that people may look for to tell them that they have unhealthy gut bacteria without going through these tests?
Great question. And see, and here's the problem, mate, is I would say to you it's more the majority of society who has a variety of different gut symptoms. And the gut symptoms start at your mouth and end up at your backside. And what are they? They can be anything from bad breath to not having a great appetite, to nausea, to vomiting, to abdominal pain, to bloating, to diarrhea, to constipation, to reflux, to all, and most of us have that, one of those symptoms or a few of those symptoms at some stage throughout the year. So as I said, it's more the majority rather than the minority who get this stuff. And you say, well, why do we get so many gut symptoms in our society? Because we're living against our physiology. What's our physiology? Wake up in the morning, pick up the spear, wander around the jungle to find food. You only eat food if the food's freely available and the food's completely natural. Of course, there's no prehistoric Kelvinators. They had to eat the food straight away if they killed the beast, and they just ate nuts and berries off the tree and only drank water. What do? breakfast, lunch, dinner, sitting our bums all day, processed packaged muck masquerading as food. We wonder why our gut bacteria aren't healthy anymore.
If you think, if you're listening to us this afternoon and you think, well, hang on a tick, I've got a fairly healthy diet. I mean, I don't eat a lot of rubbishy food. I don't drink a lot of alcohol. I have my my servings of vegetables and fruit every day. Are those people likely to have good gut bacteria?
No, more likely to have good gut bacteria than the people who don't do those things. But still, the problem is there are so many variables now in society. So, for example, children who are delivered by cesarean have defective gut bacteria compared with children who have a natural birth. Children who are given a lot of antibiotics during their childhood, and I've got to say to you, I'm one of those kids. Every time I had a bit of a sniffle, my mother would head me up to the doctor, and I'd be on some sort of antibiotic. I've had far too many courses of antibiotics personally throughout my life. I'm sure that's pulverized my gut bacteria. So, but as you so rightly say, what is the best way to have a healthy gut is to eat healthy, natural food. Now, the problem is even our good quality fruits and vegetables aren't as natural as just picking it straight off the tree or picking it out of your garden and eating it straight away, because we don't live like that anymore.
How bad is alcohol for our gut bacteria?
Oh, it's not good. I mean, to have possibly a couple of glasses of red might have some reasonable effect. But I'll be talking next week about a study that's come out recently saying that there is zero benefit from any alcohol at all.
I read that article, Ross, yes.
Yes, well, we'll discuss that next week, not this week.
Okay.
Can alcohol cause a problem? Of course it is. Alcohol is a cellular poison to every cell in the body. We have 40 trillion human cells and about 40 trillion bacterial cells, and alcohol doesn't help any of them.
Okay, let's talk about vitamin C. They say that mega doses of vitamin C are showing success in intensive care units' biggest killer, sepsis. Mm. Tell me more about sepsis. What is sepsis?
Yeah, it's a great question. Sepsis is when you get a bad infection that then spills into your bloodstream and releases all of these toxins that then can have an effect that can even lead to organ failure. And so basically, it's not just the bug itself, but it's all the other chemicals that are released by the bug. So we all heard time and time again, when the COVID pandemic started, thank God it's finished now, it's still around, but the pandemic's finished. But when that all started, we all heard this term cytokine storm. You remember that, that being said?
Yeah.
Now, what cytokines are these inflammatory chemicals released by our white cells as a response to infection. So the people who are getting very, very ill from COVID were getting this cytokine storm, because then the immune system would go wrong and release the wrong sort of chemicals in too big a dose, because it was trying its best to kill COVID. But because it released too many of these chemicals, we then had a drop in our blood pressure, the tissue started to melt down, we got organ failure. That is sepsis. So it doesn't have to be COVID. It can be any bug, whether it's a bacteria, a virus, or any microbe can induce a sepsis. Typically, it's the heavy things we hear, like the golden staph or the Klebsiellas or the bad E. coli's, that cause sepsis. And so it has a very, very strong death rate in people who get sepsis. So the death rate's about 20%. One in five people who get sepsis typically are admitted to intensive care unit, and they've got a 20% chance of dying. So we need good treatments for sepsis. So obviously trying to kill the bug with an antibiotic or an antiviral, it's a virus, that's a good thing to do. But this study that was done in the Austin Hospital in Melbourne used mega doses of intravenous vitamin C. Now, again, there are two schools of thought around the world. There's the conservative doctors who think that all vitamins give you is expensive urine. But this study is also suggesting it gives you expensive blood. So they tweaked to this when one fellow was admitted to the Austin Hospital with severe COVID. They gave him mega doses of intravenous vitamin C. He was on a ventilator, and after 12 days of being given the high-dose vitamin C, was taken off the ventilator. 22 days was discharged from the hospital without any complications. Now, that is a clinical anecdote. That is not a clinical trial. But they have used this intravenous vitamin C in a large animal study with marked improvements in their clinical state, temperature, improved heart, kidney, lung and liver function with no side effects. So there's been a few studies backing this up with people who are critically ill with sepsis around the world, but a few have said it did absolutely nothing. But I still think it shows promise because at the moment what we do with sepsis, high-dose antibiotics, ventilatory support, circulatory support, and sometimes some monoclonal antibodies to help, but there's not a lot, and steroids, but there's not much more, and you just have to wait to see if the person responds. So I think it's good that we've got another potential treatment in our armamentarium against this dreadful condition.
Who can get sepsis?
Anybody.
Anybody.
But typically, for example, with COVID, it was the very old, the very sick with other conditions and the very overweight. They were the standard people to get bad COVID. And it's the same thing with sepsis. With any medical complication of any disease, it's typically older people with defective, because as you get older, your immune system doesn't work as well, or people with a lot of comorbid conditions like heart disease, like diabetes, like treatment for cancer, like autoimmune disease, or very, very overweight people who, because when you're overweight, people say, well, aren't we just being fattest and making comments about people who are overweight? No, the problem is when your blood has to pump blood to the extra areas of your body you don't need, i.e. the big fat bellies and the fat in the organs, things don't work as well. The whole system breaks down from this. So there's a lot of carnage that goes from being very overweight. So anyone can, but even a totally healthy person who has nothing wrong with them, depending on the severity of the bug at the wrong time, can also get very sick from this.
What are the signs of sepsis?
Oh, the signs are firstly the signs of infection, whether it might be fever, it could be, depending on where the infection is, you might have a wound infection that's getting very, very red and inflamed and horrible. But you could also have a bad chest infection like pneumonia, a urinary tract infection that can then spill over into the bloodstream and then cause all the things like the drop in your blood pressure, the change in your mentation so people can get a bit delirious from all this. And then their circulation could just collapse and go into kidney failure. So sepsis is a serious, serious medical condition.
There was an article in one of the papers on the weekend, Ross. You may not have seen it because you were away, and it tells the story of a man that ended up, he got sepsis, and they saved his life, but he lost both his arms and both his legs as a result of it.
Yeah, and there's a lot of these what we call necrotizing bugs, like meningococcus, which obviously causes meningitis. That can also cause a severe vasculitis where basically your periphery get gangrenous and you can lose your arms and legs. But any of these bugs, staph can do it. All the bugs we've been talking about can still cause that. It's a horrible, horrible condition.
There's a new study out, just before I let you go, that prostate cancer treatments can be avoided or delayed in many cases. The long-term study found that 97% is the survival rate among men with prostate cancer at 15 years, regardless of whether the disease was treated or not.
Absolutely. Again, published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And this was just over 1,600 men aged between 50 to 70 who were diagnosed with prostate cancer and then followed for 15 years. So whether they had what we call active monitoring, i.e. no treatment, just checking on how they're going, a radical prostatectomy or radiotherapy, they really had a very similar outcome. Although, let me say, in the active monitoring group, there was around a 9% rate of metastases where obviously the cancer had spread, as opposed to about 5% the prostatectomy and 5% the radiation group. So there is a much higher rate of the cancer spreading, but it still shows that for many men, it's very reassuring to men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer, is regardless of the therapy you have, 97% of men are still alive after 15 years.
My dad got prostate cancer, and I remember one of the first things the urologist said to my father, and I imagine a lot of men have heard this, said to them if they have unfortunately been diagnosed with prostate cancer, and that is, many men die with prostate cancer, not as a direct result of prostate cancer.
There's no doubt about that. But the question, and this is the difficult question for all urologists who are involved in the care of people with prostate cancer, who are the ones who are going to get the aggressive prostate cancer and then possibly pass on over the next few years, but who are the 97% who are going to survive? And so do you treat everyone aggressively because of those small percentage of people who get the problem? But if you're the person with the problem, you want the best and most aggressive treatment possible.
Absolutely. Dr. Ross, it's always a delight to chat with you. Thank you for your time this week. We'll talk to you next Tuesday, as we say, same time, same channel.
Good on you, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
Likewise, Ross. Thanks, mate. Bye-bye. Bye. That's Dr. Ross Walker. As we say, if you've got a question for him, please send it to us via email. What we will do is we will send it to him via email, and he'll answer it on the radio for you next week.